service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. For the next hour, I will be reading from the Triangle Business Journal. The cover story this week, Wilson's new cash crop, baseball. For an eastern North Carolina city, baseball stadium spurs hope for downtown revitalization. Before we get to the cover story, we'll read the Biz section and the reporter pages. Biz is written by managing editor Dane Huffman, and in keeping with the cover story, the top story in Biz is Device Helps Umps Keep the Games Moving. Keeping up with the baseball theme from our cover story, a local entrepreneur with a background in basketball officiating has landed a key deal with the Atlantic Coast Conference for a device that helps umpires and referees. The ACC will use the Whistle Stop device in baseball this year and softball next year as a way to help umpires better manage the pitch clock. And Whistle Stop President Keith Fogelman says the goal is to reach other sports as well, including basketball. Basically, the umpires wear small waist packs that sync to scoreboard systems and use vibrations to alert the umpire as the clock is winding down. The device means colleges don't have to pay someone to manage the clock in the press box, and umpires don't have to watch the clock as closely while trying to manage a game. Clock management has become a rising issue in sports, especially in baseball, as administrators look to cut down on games that stretch well past 3 hours. It keeps the game moving, says Fogelman, who says the umpires like not having to watch the clock so often. The Whistle Stop devices are manufactured in Canada, and then the company leases them to clients. The 3-year deal with the ACC is just a start, Fogelman says. Fogelman has other deals in place, including with the Southeastern Conference for softball, and sees potential in other sports, especially basketball and hockey. He's now negotiating to have the device used at the College World Series. This is new for everybody, but now when we have 100, 150 of these out, especially if we get into the College World Series, it will be a no-brainer for every conference in the country, Fogelman says. St. Augs scrambles to maintain accreditation. St. Augustine's University in Raleigh dates back to 1867 and has faced tough times before, but the historically black school is in survival mode now as it tries to retain its accreditation. About a week after losing an appeal, the university wrote the Southern Association of Colleges and Schools Commission on Colleges requesting arbitration. The commission received the letter March 11th, kicking off a 90-day process during which the university will remain accredited. The accrediting agency voted in December to remove St. Augustine's from its membership after years of financial challenges. St. Augustine's recently has failed to pay employees and owes the Internal Revenue Service nearly $8 million. Without accreditation, a university can't receive federal funds, and its students can't receive federal student aid from the U.S. Department of Education. St. Paul's College in Virginia, another historic HBCU that once played in the CIAA, closed after similar issues in 2013. SAS to help Raleigh police detect criminal patterns. The Raleigh Police Department has secured nearly $630,000 for a new public safety intelligence management system. According to the Office of U.S. Representative Deborah Ross, the project has RPD partnering with carrier analytics giant SAS to provide real-time actionable information on crime patterns and emergencies. The money comes from the Omnibus Funding Package for fiscal year 2024, part of more than $12.6 million secured for community projects across Wake County. Affordable housing gets boost. An affordable apartment community in Raleigh has secured federal, county, and city funding. CASA is planning 10 units in partnership with the Hope Center at Pullen at 601 Method Road. The units will be inside the Beltline near the NC State University campus. The project, projected to cost $2.5 million, received $1 million in federal funding, $760,000 from Wake County, and $700,000 from the City of Raleigh. Casey Angel, vice chair of the board for CASA, says the project might also require a construction loan. The units will be for children who age out of foster care system and have nowhere to live. The Hope Center will provide referrals along with case management and supportive services. Each unit will be about 600 square feet, and there will be a shared laundry facility on site. Cottage homes come at a cost. A developer plans to build more cottage-style homes in West Raleigh due to strong demand. Redeeming Development Group of Raleigh has filed a subdivision plans for Chapman Cottages, a 15-home development on 2.3 acres near Powell Drive Park, just outside Interstate 440. The company says it has already sold all of its cottages in the Grove at Powell Park. The homes at Chapman Cottages will be 1,800 square feet with three bedrooms. The company hasn't set a listing price yet, but Chris Hodges with Redeeming Development Group says prices might be in the $700,000s. That would mean nearly $390 per square foot for a home listed at $700,000. And speaking of homes, price for Carey Mansion jumps to $9.6 million. A Triangle investor, Swank Home and Carey, remains on the market nearly 2 years after it was listed, but at a higher price. The mansion at 102 Anna Lake Lane was listed in May 2022 for $8.3 million. Listing activity shows it was pulled last summer for a few weeks before being put back on the market for $9.6 million. The home is owned by David Gardner, founder of Carey's Co-Founders Capital. In 2022, he said his family was planning to move to a new high-rise in Durham that will have elite condo units. The development called The Novus is on track to open next year. Lauren Onosorge writes the On Transit and Startups column or section. Her top story this week, 2025 target for start of new bus rapid transit. New Bern Avenue is to be the launch for Raleigh's new bus approach. Transportation planners are in the final stages of preparation before construction begins along New Bern Avenue in Raleigh for the region's first bus rapid transit corridor. The first phase of the plan in Wake County is a 5.3-mile route connecting downtown Raleigh with New Hope Road. The $96 million vision for the corridor is a system of uninterrupted bus lanes separated from general traffic. The city held a ceremonial groundbreaking last year, but the real construction has yet to start. In recent months, drivers may have noticed utility relocations starting along the stretch. The next step is the bidding process, says Sam Brewer, a project manager with the city. He says the goal is to get a bid award approved by the city council this summer. Bid advertisements went out early this month, and already the city has had significant interest from potential contractors, Brewer says. Once a contractor has been tapped, the city will convene a pre-construction meeting with the public to introduce the team and outline expectations. If all goes as expected, the city hopes the stretch will be complete by the end of 2025. Work begins on $90 million rollout to startups. A pool of $90 million is being deployed to North Carolina startups, and the real work begins now. 10 minority and women-led venture capital firms have been awarded a combined $32 million. The announcement out of the NC Invest Initiative, managed by the NC Rural Center, brought Vice President Kamala Harris and other dignitaries to Durham on March 1st. On top of the $32 million, they've signed commitments to invest a total of $90 million in North Carolina startups. Keith Daniel, co-founder of one of those funds, Durham's Resilient Ventures, says work is underway and the first investment is in sight. Resilient is targeting a $15 million second fund and is making good progress, he says, declining to talk specifics. But I can say that this has been an important milestone for us in our second fund, Daniel says. Wingo's Spiffy acquires Texas firm. Spiffy, a car care startup co-founded by serial entrepreneur Scott Wingo, is deploying some of the $30 million it raised last year to acquire a competitor. The Research Triangle Park company announced its acquisition of Nuvin Air of Houston this month. Financial details were not released. Wingo says it's a move to bulk up the company's device business. While the core of Spiffy is in on-demand car care, it does have a growing device segment with homegrown products such as Smart Tumbler, a rechargeable device meant to combat odors, and Easy Tread, a tire sensing and analysis system. Nuvin Air pushes out vehicle cleaning technologies competing with Smart Tumbler. Spiffy liked the space and wanted to grow Smart Tumbler quickly, he says. Zach Ezone is the writer of the On Healthcare and Higher Education section. His main story this week, FDA cites potential issues at Indivior. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration has flagged potential issues at a manufacturing facility that a global pharmaceutical company recently acquired in Raleigh. Indivior in November acquired a site in Northeast Raleigh and unveiled plans to invest more than $60 million in the facility over the next 5 years. The company, based near Richmond, Virginia, plans to use the site to produce treatments for opioid addiction and schizophrenia. After Indivior acquired the roughly 80,000-square-foot facility, the FDA conducted a site inspection focusing on manufacturing practices related to a product that Indivior makes for a third party. The federal regulator made 6 observations on a Form 483, a document used to identify potential quality or regulatory issues or other infractions. Indivior, which disclosed the Form 483 in its recent annual financial filing, did not provide details on the FDA's observations. The company declines to provide specific details. "We will update with more information as appropriate," a spokesperson says. The FDA declined to comment on the inspection. A spokesperson for the agency says, "As a general policy, the FDA does not discuss specific compliance matters except with the entity involved." In its financial filing, Indivior says it has provided a remediation action plan to the FDA. If the FDA accepts this plan, Indivior expects the federal regulator to review those efforts during the facility's next inspection. The FDA issued more than 4,000 Form 483s between October 2022 and September 2023, more than half of which were related to food. About 500 of the reports were related to drugs, and more than 700 were related to devices, according to data from the FDA. Indivior in November paid about $5 million in cash up front for the Raleigh facility. Additionally, as part of the purchase, Indivior took on pre-existing obligations to manufacture drugs and other products for third parties. These onerous contracts carry a $28 million provision, as the expected cost to fulfill these contracts area in excess of the economic benefits. Indivior is expected to receive, according to the SEC filing. The company plans to eventually phase out this contract work and develop the site to support the long-term production and supply of Sublocade, an opioid addiction treatment, and Perseris, a schizophrenia treatment. In Morrisville, Japanese pharma to cut more jobs. A Japanese drug maker with a presence in Morrisville is cutting about 400 employees. Sumitomo Pharma is reducing the size of its U.S. subsidiary in an effort to improve organizational efficiency. This follows a 2023 restructuring that resulted in hundreds of layoffs, including a local subsidiary losing nearly half its employees. Sumitomo did not say what sites would be impacted by the latest layoffs. Last year, it implemented a restructuring that brought together U.S. subsidiaries to create Sumitomo Pharma America. This included Enzyvant Therapeutics, a biopharma with an office in Cary and manufacturing facility in Morrisville. Biotech targeting ALS raises millions despite difficult odds. A biotechnology firm in Durham has raised millions of dollars and is potentially looking to add more. Avicenna Biosciences raised $6 million in debt from a single investor, according to a recent filing with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. The startup set the total offering amount to $10 million. Avicenna is a drug development company that uses machine learning-enhanced medicinal chemistry that accelerates the process of identifying a lead candidate for small molecule drug development, according to the North Carolina Biotechnology Center. The company is developing a drug candidate targeting amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, also called ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease. With the new funding, Avicenna has raised about $11.5 million since September 2020, according to previous SEC filings. This includes a $3 million raise in 2022 and a $2.5 million raise in 2020. The company couldn't be reached to comment on the funding. Avicenna was incorporated in North Carolina in October 2020. The SEC filing identifies Christopher Meldrum, Thomas Kaiser, and Peter Berger as executive officers and directors. The raise comes amid a continued dip in venture capital deals in the biopharma sector. Deal activity reached about $54.4 billion in value in 2021, before dropping to $36.7 billion in 2022 and $29.9 billion in 2023. The On Retail and Restaurants section is written by Laura Brummett. The top story there this week, Cary's Lone Strip Club is on the move. Pure Gold Premier Gentlemen's Club will close in downtown Cary this month as the business moves to its new location. The club's prime spot at 301 North Harrison Avenue is being eyed by the town for a new transit center, part of a larger plan to redevelop multiple sites downtown. The strip club's new home is at 2940 Pleasant Grove Road, Pleasant Grove Church Road. The property is just minutes from the airport but has a Cary address. Pure Gold, which has been operating in Cary for more than 30 years, will close at the end of the month, and Cheetah will open on March 29th, according to the ownership team's attorney, Mike Barber. It's the same group that owns the Cheetah Clubs in Wilmington and Southern Pines. Pure Gold is the only strip club in Cary. Its ownership group, operating as Pleasant Grove Golf and Travel Holdings, LLC, is comprised of chiropractor Randy Shilsky and other silent partners. The new Cheetah location in Cary was built on vacant land and measures nearly 13,000 square feet. Pleasant Grove Golf and Travel Holdings purchased the 2.76 acres for $950,000 in 2021. The club will be Las Vegas-style, Barber says, and will feature a full kitchen, a bar, an outdoor patio, televisions, and VIP spaces. The new building cost will be $3.88 million, according to filings. The ownership team was notified by its landlord that the building housing Pure Gold would be torn down to make way for the town of Cary's plans, Barber says. The town worked with the club's ownership to find a new location where the zoning allowed a strip club. The ownership group chose the location for its zoning, ample distance from residential housing and proximity to several hotels. The current Pure Gold property is owned by LLCs registered to Tammy Russell, Aaron Reed, and Carl Reed, Jr. The group purchased the property in 2005 for $2.1 million. A gas station also operates on the lot with a sports bar in the building's lower level. Indoor karting in Durham eyes opening date. Andretti Indoor Karting and Games and Entertainment Destination in the new Top Golf development in Durham is set to open next spring. The Florida company has purchased land off Page Road for its facility and has its site plans approved. Plans for the concept were revealed in November 2022 and are now approved by the city and show an 89,000-square-foot building sitting on 6.96 acres. The building will have an indoor karting track, 8 bowling lanes, a kitchen, dining room, full bar, laser tag, and gaming space. The building will also have a small second-floor area with event space. Andretti Indoor Karting purchased the lot for $3.68 million in February, deed records show. RealtyLink, based in Greenville, South Carolina, is the developer of the Top Golf project in Durham. Exchange Project adds fitness club. Lifetime, operator of upscale athletic clubs, will open a new fitness facility and beach club in the Exchange Raleigh development, accompanied by an integrated Lifetime living apartment building. The Exchange Raleigh is a more than $1 billion mixed-use development under construction near North Hills, developed by DeWitt Carolinas. Lifetime will open an 80,000-square-foot fitness facility, including a rooftop beach club. The building will rise 3 stories and feature fitness class studios as well as massage rooms. The facility will also include a co-working lounge and a full-service Life Cafe. The residential portion of the Raleigh project will be the 7th Lifetime living location. Ben Tobin writes a section on Greater Triangle growth. His top story this week is in Chatham County. $11 million land deal pushes development ahead. A large mixed-use development on the border of Wake and Chatham counties is picking up steam as the developer recently bought dozens of acres for more than $11 million. An LLC tied to Beacon Partners of Charlotte acquired 83 acres in eastern Chatham County for $11.6 million last month, according to Chatham County deed records. That comes out to roughly $140,000 per acre. The land will go toward Apex Gateway, a 375-acre commercial and industrial development at the western edge of Apex. Walker Gorham, who leads Beacon's expansion efforts in the Triangle, says the land purchase is part of the project's second phase, which will include roughly 243 acres. We have closed on most of the Phase 2 acreage, and the remaining Phase 2 parcel closings will occur over the course of the next 6 months, Gorham says. Site work for all 132 acres in our first phase will be complete this spring, and our first 3 buildings will deliver later this summer. Situated at the intersection of U.S. Highway 64 and NC Highway 751 on the Chatham side of the Chatham-Wake border, the Apex Gateway will contain 5 industrial buildings as part of its first phase, including a 163,000-square-foot building that will serve as the new headquarters for the Durham Coca-Cola Bottling Company. Overall, the project will span more than 1 million square feet, with the second phase focusing on retail and restaurant space. Beacon Partners has spent millions on land for the project over the past year. In early December, the company acquired about 14.2 acres in eastern Chatham for more than $4.5 million. In October, the group acquired roughly 10.4 acres for the second phase of the project for more than $1.45 million. And in June, the group acquired 42.22 acres in Chatham for $4.4 million. In Moore County, Golf Hub surges in economic strength. The rapid growth happening in Moore County is driving the area to new heights for economic strength. The Pinehurst Southern Pines area has received designation as being one of the strongest micropolitan areas in the United States. The region remains the top micropolitan area in North Carolina and is now number 10 in the country, according to Polycom, an economic research firm based in Florida. Last year, the Pinehurst Southern Pines area ranked number 21, up from 39 in 2022 and number 53 in 2021. Polycom determined the rankings by evaluating 23 economic factors covering a 19-year period and analyzing why particular economies are growing or declining. A micropolitan is defined by the U.S. Office of Management and Budget as an urbanized area that has more than 10,000 people but less than 50,000 people and includes at least one county. Moore County, with a population that now tops 105,000, is growing beyond its longtime status as a golf and retirement destination. In Lee County, oil recycling company buys Sanford plant. A Sanford business that recycles oil recently paid millions for a facility in the city. Noble Oil Services Incorporated bought a 50,684 square foot building at 5108 Rex McLeod Drive for $5 million on March 1st, according to Lee County deed records. The previous owner, Cat 3 Properties LLC of Cary, bought the building in 2021 for $3.25 million. That LLC is tied to the James J. Noble Revocable Trust, the trust for the founder of the company who died in June of 2023. It's unclear why Noble Oil Services, Inc. decided to purchase the property. Company representatives did not respond to requests for comment. Kaylee Thompson writes about real estate. In downtown Raleigh, more units are on the way at Seaboard Station. The $122 million project will complete phase two of a years-long development in downtown Raleigh. The Seaboard Station development by Hoffman & Associates is getting a seven-story residential building called The Miles, with more than 45,000 square feet of retail space on its ground floor. The Miles will also offer a wide array of amenities for residents. Hoffman started construction on The Miles in June 2022 and plans to open the building to residents this summer. Leasing is expected to begin this spring. The building will have 204 apartments, offering studio and 1, 2, and 3-bedroom units. It will also offer 3 townhouse-style residences on the 3rd and 4th floors. Rental rates for the apartments will be comparable to the Signal apartments in Seaboard Station, where 1-bedroom units are listed at around $1,850 a month. John Florian, Executive Vice President of Development for Hoffman & Associates, says the company is planning a third phase for Seaboard Station, located off Peace Street across from William Peace University, but hasn't entered the design stage yet. Some units at the Miles will have barn-style bedroom doors, Spanish quartz countertops, stainless steel appliances, wine cabinets, bars and fridges, and smart home technology. Almost every unit will have a private balcony. Some of the amenities offered will be a swimming pool with sun shelf, hammocks, day beds, outdoor TV lounge, fitness center with Peloton bikes, outdoor turf exercise area, co-working spaces, game room, and entertainment kitchen. The company is looking to sign more food and beverage tenants for the retail space, along with entertainment-focused offerings. Hoffman expects to make retail announcements for both this project and the retail space at The Point Apartments in the next few months. Retailers who have already committed to Seaboard Station include Biscuit Belly, Starbucks, and Sweat House. The development is part of the transformation occurring around the Northern Gateway into downtown Raleigh. Turnbridge Equities is working on plans to transform Logan's Garden Shop and the Seaboard Train Station into a mixed-use development with two towers. site of new Raleigh homes auction off. A Raleigh property that's the site of new townhomes was recently sold at auction for $6.5 million as part of a foreclosure process. According to public records, Charlotte home builder Verde Homes defaulted on its loan tied to townhomes it built along Newbern Avenue. That resulted in the property, 801 Newbern Avenue, going into foreclosure, according to Wake County property records. Records show Verde Homes also defaulted on a loan tied to property at 906 Newbern Avenue, which had been cleared for development. Durham-Chapel Hill Corridor adds homes. A growing corridor between Durham and Chapel Hill is in line to get 1,000 new residential units. MI Homes of Ohio has filed a rezoning and annexation request to build Moriah Bridge on 155 acres near the New Hope Commons Shopping Center off Highway 501. Part of the land is in Chapel Hill, but the home builder wants to have it annexed into Durham to access the city's utilities. The proposed rezoning is planned development residential. Current zoning on the site is residential suburban and rural transition district. Vice President of Land, Erica Leatham, says MI Homes hopes to have the rezoning approved by this fall and to break ground in late 2026. The share of units hasn't been finalized yet, though Leatham says it will probably be about a third each for apartments, townhouses, and single-family homes. Our cover story this week, Build It and They Will Come. For an Eastern North Carolina city, baseball stadium spurs hope for development revitalization. The article by Ben Tobin. When Chase Riker first attended Barton College, a liberal arts school in Wilson, in 2016, nobody went downtown. That was years before the Eastern North Carolina city, a former tobacco hub with a stagnant population, focused on revitalizing its downtown. It's an important step for Wilson, where the population dropped by more than 1,600 residents between 2018 and 2022. To reverse that, Wilson has supported investments of more than $100 million that brought a 240-unit apartment building, a new YMCA center, and a new parking deck to downtown. The fruits of that investment are apparent. Riker, who is opening a couple of businesses in Wilson, says once vacant buildings are being populated by bars, eateries, and more. All this is the beginning of what Wilson hopes is a full-fledged downtown revitalization. Next up, a more than $280 million project to build a new stadium for the Carolina Mudcats, the single-A baseball team now based in Zebulon. The stadium is scheduled to open for the 2026 season. I see that baseball stadium driving people in probably a two-hour radius around here to Wilson, Riker says. So bringing more people to see Wilson and how special it is, that's the way you'll get even more investment in this community. As the Research Triangle grows and surrounding counties follow suit, Wilson has been left behind as vacant buildings fill up what was once a booming urban core. A new baseball stadium could help recapture some of that energy the city once had, just as leaders say baseball parks have done for trodden downtowns in Fayetteville and Kannapolis. That's the goal for Wilson City Manager Grant Goings. Wilson is working with NSV Development of Durham to build the new stadium and surrounding hotels, apartments, and commercial development. As part of the partnership, Wilson is committing $70 million for the stadium. That move could force a tax raise of as much as 2 cents per $100 valuation on the property tax rate, but with the addition of a private sector partner, Goings says the investment will mostly pay for itself. Still, the stadium concept is not a surefire bet. Some economists believe that public funding baseball stadiums are poor investments that do not spur the investments municipalities seek. Even worse, the teams can move away once a lease expires, leaving municipalities with empty stadiums and wasted taxpayer money. Goings is confident this won't be the case for Wilson. We feel as comfortable as possible that the burden on the taxpayers here will be minimized by all the new investment. He says the current tax base of the entire downtown area is less than $100 million, and the guaranteed investment for this project alone is over $200 million. He adds, I don't use the word transformational very often, but this is a transformational project for downtown Wilson. In 2021, Major League Baseball announced a new set of standards for minor league teams, including upgrades for the operations and facilities of stadiums. These changes sent many teams scrambling for options, including the Mudcats, who play at Five County Stadium in Zebulon. for the stadium, which is 85% owned by Wake County and 15% owned by the town of Zebulon, Wake County commissioners considered north of $15 million worth of upgrades. Meanwhile, NSV Development founder and chairman Michael Lemansky, who had been part of a group that acquired and redeveloped more than 20 distressed properties in downtown Durham earlier in the 21st century, explored the potential for a stadium with Wilson leaders. NSV Development had been behind the $100 million of investment in downtown Wilson, which Lemansky says was a demonstration project in which local government really proved themselves with necessary public investments. And paired with having the land to build a stadium, Wilson is acquiring 15 parcels by the Wallace Simpson Whirligig Park and a baseball culture baked into the city. Wilson was a strong contender for a team, Lemansky says. We knew about the land, we knew about the culture, and once we found out that the local government was serious, it was very clear the next step was to find out if the Milwaukee Brewers would consider moving the Carolina Mudcats, Lemansky said. NSV Development ran point on conversations with the Brewers, who bought the Mudcats from Steve Bryant in 2017. Conversations started roughly a year and a half ago and gradually grew more serious, Lemansky says. It's been a mad scramble, he says. We gave them a tour and showed them around and introduced them to the city, and I think from the very beginning they were intrigued by the opportunity. It's not a very far distance between Zebulon and Wilson. On top of the stadium, Lemansky says NSV Development is planning to build an 118-room hotel attached to the stadium, an apartment building overlooking the stadium, and everything from affordable housing to high-end housing and everything in between. We think that's how the market can absorb more growth faster, but it also just creates a more exciting, fun, and dynamic environment that can support the retail and some of the other sort of amenities that you'd like to add to the downtown, he says. Part of NSV Development's credibility with the city of Wilson is that the company had been part of recent baseball projects in Kannapolis and Fayetteville. Like Wilson, Kannapolis and Fayetteville have struggled with attracting people downtown. The Kannapolis Cannonballers, a single-A affiliate of the Chicago White Sox, have played in Atrium Health Ballpark since 2021. The move to build that stadium was twofold, according to Kannapolis City Manager Mike Legg. First, like Wilson, the city was in the middle of a downtown revitalization effort, and they needed a downtown anchor that would serve as a catalyst to attract visitors. Outside of a baseball stadium, the city had considered a performing arts center and a children's museum per leg. The other factor was that the team was playing in a multi-decade-old stadium. We kind of knew that if we didn't make major improvements or relocate it, we would probably lose our minor league team, Legg says. Kannapolis invested $113 million in the project, which included a mix of residential and commercial components on top of the stadium, while NSV Development invested $250 million. And the move has paid off in spades, per leg. The same year the Cannonballers started playing at Atrium Health Ballpark, a mixed-use project called VITA, which consists of 289 apartment units, broke ground. Additional apartment projects have followed, Legg says. Before we started the project, we had maybe two or three actual viable businesses in all of downtown, Lick says. It was all pretty much shut down, and so we took literally nothing and created what's here. Kannapolis hadn't been the same since Pillowtex Corp. filed for bankruptcy in 2003, resulting in the mass layoff of roughly 5,000 workers at its Cannon Mills plant. When the city purchased 50 acres downtown in September 2015, there were 28 businesses, including some small office space, and total property value was just shy of $18.4 million, according to Kannapolis spokeswoman Annette Privet-Keller. Today, there are 58 businesses downtown, and the total property value sits at more than $117 million. Similarly, Fayetteville also looked to baseball to help restore downtown. The Fayetteville Woodpeckers, the single-A affiliate of the Houston Astros, have played in Segra Stadium since 2019. The project cost roughly $40 million and was developed via a public-private partnership. As we have worked to build more vibrancy downtown, minor league baseball has served as a good catalyst for that, Fayetteville Mayor Mitch Colvin says. In the middle of the 20th century, downtown Fayetteville was bustling, full of department stores such as Sears and JCPenney, movie theaters, and numerous businesses. But in 1975, the opening of a shopping mall west of the city took away many big shops from downtown, and the downtown area, especially around Hay Street, became shoddy and seedy. but that has changed. Colvin points to the residences at the Prince Charles, a 59-unit apartment building right by Sagra Stadium that had long been a vacant former hotel as part of a $17 million project, as an example of the type of investment spurred on by the baseball stadium. He also says downtown occupancy rates are much higher for businesses than they were prior to the stadium being built. We have seen great movement on Hay Street by the stadium. I think it's probably around 80% to 90% occupancy downtown now, and it was well below that before the stadium was completed. Economists are not sold, but if you ask J.C. Bradbury, a Charlotte area native and professor of economics, finance, and quantitative analysis at Kennesaw State University, minor league baseball stadiums are terrible investments. No local government should enter into such an investment with an expectation of a positive return, he says. They're boondoggle after boondoggle, and it's why minor league teams set up shop and then move somewhere else after the lease expires. Bradbury points to the Atlanta Braves AA team as a cautionary tale. In 1984, the Braves selected Greenville, South Carolina, as a recipient for their team, playing in the new Greenville Municipal Stadium. But after 20 years, the Braves announced a move to Pearl, Mississippi. The Mississippi Stadium didn't go according to plan, according to a Bloomberg article from 2016 titled, "The Braves Play Taxpayers Better Than They Play Baseball." The city of Pearl took out $28 million to pay for the stadium, and taxes and fees weren't enough to cover the debt. In 2013 and 2014, the city had to pay north of $900,000 of taxpayer money to cover shortfalls. And at the start of this year, the Braves announced the team would move to Columbus, Georgia in 2025, wasting millions of dollars in Pearl. There's just been a long record of stadiums being very bad public investments, Bradbury says. There are just so many more things that seem to be better uses of taxpayer funds. Goings, the Wilson city manager, is confident the city will not face a similar fate as other cities with this project. He says having NSV development as part of the deal will ensure that the investment pays for itself. And the Mudcats have signed a 25-year lease to play in the new stadium. A really critical component to understand about this project is that it's a three-party agreement. Goings says in some projects you have a two-party agreement between a team and a municipality, but with our third leg, a private sector developer is guaranteeing the tax base to pay for the stadium. Having worked on the projects in Fayetteville and Kannapolis, Lemanski echoes that sentiment, saying minor league baseball stadiums have massive potential to drive private investments. It's sort of one of the best return on investments from a public investment that you can make if you're trying to drive private development and redevelop a distressed area, he says. Five County Stadium was celebrated when it opened in 1991 and even hosted the Carolina League All-Star Game that year. But 25 years later, the stadium is going to be empty. The people in my district hate to see the stadium go, says Wake County Commissioner Don Mile, who represents where the stadium is located. A lot of people have a lot of fond memories of taking the kids and spending time in the state and watching the Mudcats play. Mile says that he and his colleagues did everything we could feasibly to keep the Mudcats, but everybody likes a new house, and they couldn't compete with what Wilson was offering. Zebulon Town Manager Joe Moore says that improvements to the stadium to meet MLB's new requirements would have cost anywhere between $7.5 million and $22.5 million. Moore says renovations to the stadium could still be on the table as the town plans to utilize it as part of an entertainment sports district. With the stadium being located right off U.S. 264, Moore says the stadium is really convenient for travel baseball and tournaments, and land near the stadium is ripe for residential and commercial projects, including additional athletic facilities, he said. You don't necessarily look to the stadium to be a major generator of revenue. It never has been, Moore says. We are providing a community gathering place. There's an unquantifiable return on something that brings your community together. Meanwhile, Mile is bullish that with some updates, the stadium could be hosting another baseball team in the near future. We would love to get another team in here, Mile says. I think the stadium is in great shape. We want to try to continue to work with Zebulon and do what we can to improve the stadium there. But the fact remains the changes are ahead. In just 2 years, Wilson, with a population of 47,000, will have a minor league baseball team, and Wake County, with 1.2 million people, will not. The Editor's Notebook opinion column is written by Managing Editor Sugata Mukherjee. The state's next big headache, online gambling. on March 11th, anyone living in North Carolina over 21 can legally gamble online. If you did not receive hundreds of emails and texts from gambling sites such as FanDuel, BetMGM, DraftKings, and others asking you to download the app and link your bank card, I would like to know how you keep your email and cell phone information private. You will be doing a community service. North Carolina lawmakers passed the law last year, and it made sense. More than 30 states have already approved online gambling, and they all have different ways of generating revenue to help with government services for the broader public. That all sounds good, but online gambling is far more dangerous when it comes to gambling addiction when compared to, say, the lottery or physically going to a casino. Why? Because the online process requires one or two clicks. A Rutgers University study on New Jersey residents released late last year noted that sports betting is viewed as completely normal among college-aged people. The study found that 33% of the residents aged 18 to 24 are gambling online, four times as many as the 2017 numbers. Less than 2 years ago, a study conducted by the National Council on Problem Gambling showed the national risks for gambling addiction increased by almost one-third between 2018 and 2021, and that a significant percentage of the rise is attributable to men between the ages of 18 and 24. Until now, while hundreds of thousands of North Carolinians were still gambling online through offshore accounts, the fact that it is now legal will make many more download the gambling apps, especially as basketball reaches the business end of the schedule. States regulate gambling in some form, but there are no federal intervention assistance programs such as alcohol, drug, and tobacco addiction. In North Carolina, money, $2 million, received from the 18% tax levied on online gambling operators will be used by the Department of Health and Human Services to develop programs to assist with gambling addiction programs. That's a start. But the state may also consider working with banks and financial institutions to explore if there can be some ways to determine if customer behavior has changed since gambling became legal. Of course, individuals are responsible for their financial debt issues, not financial institutions. So what levers can be pulled to identify customers who may be on their way to serious financial trouble? Then there's the issue of how the online gambling operators are marketing the services to youths. In the U.S., Harvard Health notes about 1% of adults, 2 million, are estimated to have a severe gambling problem, and 2% to 3%, which is 4 million to 6 million people, are thought to have a mild or moderate problem. As the number grows, should North Carolina start looking at restricting how gambling operators can advertise their products without infringing on private businesses' rights to market their products and services legally? These are hard questions, but North Carolina will be better off in the long run if it asks operators for demographic information on gamblers in the first couple of years. The data can be aggregated to stave off privacy concerns, but we may have a better look at whether college-age adults and teens are gambling more frequently, one of the primary signs of the road to addiction. I am glad responsible adults have a legal tool to place bets on their favorite teams and individuals. Many of them were doing it anyway. Now for North Carolina, the question remains, how do we preach responsibility? The executive voice section this week focuses on Dedrick Carter. Driving innovation is his role at UNC. The interview by Zach Ezone. Dedrick Carter's new role at UNC Chapel Hill represents a homecoming. Born in North Carolina and raised in South Carolina, Carter worked in various cities, states, and countries before joining UNC in October. As Chief Innovation Officer and Vice Chancellor for Innovation, Entrepreneurship, and Economic Development, Carter is tasked with turning UNC's robust research into commercial opportunities. This involves overseeing entrepreneurial services and working with angel networks and the venture capital community. Carter joined UNC after a decade at Washington University in St. Louis, where he served as Chief Commercialization Officer. He steps into the role as UNC opens its Innovate Carolina Junction on Rosemary Street. This serves as a new innovation hub with co-working space and access to services to help local startups. Although the university has a strong research portfolio of more than $1 billion, Carter sees opportunities to further grow how this research leads to innovation that can help people and the local and regional economy. How did your career begin? I finished school at MIT and went to D.C. to a large system integration firm to lead an effort for them, starting a company. And along the way, two things happened. One, I joined the board of my alma mater, and two, I was asked to join the advisory board of the University of Virginia, and so I started digging really deeply into higher education. I was trying to figure out what was the place that had the most entrepreneurial, innovative culture that I've been in. I realized it was during my time at MIT, and so I wanted to go back there and sort of understand why. Why entrepreneurship? My older sister would tell you that when I was a kid, I used to always have some business going. If I had to take the garbage out, I sort of called it a garbage removal service. There was always some enterprise going, a sign hanging off my bedroom door. How long were you at MIT? About 5 years, and then I was offered the opportunity to be the senior advisor in the office of the director at the U.S. National Science Foundation. It was probably one of the best things I've ever done. I went from seeing one wonderful research university that I knew well to seeing thousands, both here and abroad. I got a chance to see lots of different models and realize that bits and pieces of all these things really are what makes it work in that in the environment or this culture. What did you do after NSF? My wife and I thought it's time to do something different. We were thinking about starting our family, and the opportunity presented itself at Washington University. I went there thinking I'd be there for a few years and ended up being a wonderful decade or more of our life, where we had three kids, ended up becoming vice chancellor there, and had a wonderful experience. What interested you in this move to UNC? My wife had spent some time in the Carolinas, and I grew up here. We have three little girls, and we said it would be really great to be closer to family. And I think that there's a level of excellence that is not yet tapped at UNC around commercialization and translation. There's wonderful science and a tremendous opportunity to do more. What have your first few months looked like? I've spent the last 100 days or so doing a listening tour. I've spent a lot of time talking to people who are involved in the innovation ecosystem, both internally and externally, and it's a really wonderful network. UNC is a place of enormous opportunity if you think about research. It really is sort of new and novel, findings and discovering things, but innovation, commercialization, and translation, the entrepreneurial effort is about taking those things and applying them to the human condition. How do you do that? There's something different about someone that has a mindset around translation. You're not just looking for one patent. You may be looking for an array of patents, a portfolio of patents that help you project an area and show the breadth of capability you have in a space. And that is a mindset that says, let's not just do one grant and go away, but let's sort of develop a capability in a space. And so it's training your mind and your eye and finding resources to be able to move quickly to identify those opportunities to work with faculty to increase what I call entrepreneurial intention, the desire to take research and move it in the direction of commercialization. What are the challenges in achieving those goals? Access to capital is always an issue. Access to talent, if you're starting a new venture, has become an increasing challenge. If you accelerate growth of startups and new ventures, you're going to accelerate the consumption of the talent in the space. We need to make sure that we're partnering with places like Durham Tech and community colleges to continue to have a wide base of individuals who can take the jobs. Some of it is just making sure that we don't get in our own way. As we start to think about what new looks like, there can be the sense that we've always done it this way, and that has led to a certain level of excellence. But we know that the things that got us here are going to be a part of this strong foundation for the things that help us go to the next level. And we're going to have to embrace those without losing the specialness of the culture that we have cultivated. The Project Life section concerns executive health and worker wellness in the Triangle. Time to fix breast cancer screening guidelines. This article by Sheila McHale. Recently, media reports noted that Research Triangle Park is challenging Boston as the leading area for biotech. Women, who make up 50% of our life sciences workforce, have made significant contributions to our success. But how does North Carolina treat this invaluable workforce? When it comes to women's health and wellness, not so well. The Status of Women in North Carolina report issued by the Institute for Women's Policy Research gave our state a D-plus grade on women's health and well-being. To improve, they recommend increasing women's access to health care and preventive services, including screening and testing to promote early detection of illness or disease. breast cancer screening is an essential and unique component of women's health. Breast cancer found early is almost 100% curable. Found late, there is a 70% chance a woman will die within 5 years. Later diagnosis means harsher and more costly treatment and more time out of the workforce. Women are instructed to get their mammograms, and most do. Unfortunately, mammograms miss up to 50% of tumors in dense breasts because this tissue shows up as white on a mammogram, and so does cancer. Almost 50% of women have dense breasts, and we tend to be younger women and minority women of all ages. To find our cancer timely, we need additional screening tests. Following the passage of the North Carolina Breast Density Notification Law in 2013, a study by the American College of Radiology found that women were not more frequently referred for supplemental screening, though the new use of screening with digital breast tomosynthesis, DBT, was greater for women with dense breasts. Unfortunately, in the decade since its approval, DBT is only marginally better than digital mammogram, finding just one additional tumor per 1,000 women screened. To find cancer timely, women with dense breasts need an ultrasound or a breast MRI, which respectively finds an additional 8 and 14 tumors missed by mammograms per 1,000 women screened. While given routinely to women in many other states, supplemental breast cancer screening is often not made available to North Carolina women for many reasons. First, many physicians are uneducated about the screening needs of dense breasts and cannot properly advise their patients. While radiologists are knowledgeable, women rarely interface with them. Second, many physicians and patients do not know how to properly interpret a mammogram report. Just because a mammogram report gives a BI-RADS-1, which is a negative score, and states there are no suspicious masses, calcifications, or other findings in either breast, no mammographic evidence of malignancy, recommended routine mammography screening in 1 year. That does not mean that there is no cancer. It only means that the radiologist does not see cancer in the breast tissue that can be seen by mammogram. If a woman has dense breasts, the radiologist cannot see 50% or more of the breast tissue. Third, physician guidelines such as those issued by U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, that's the USPSTF, are unclear about the use of supplemental screening for women with dense breasts, and without clarity, physicians are deterred from recommending additional screening. Fourth, physicians are worried about the stress caused by possible false positives, even though studies have found that most women are willing to undergo the stress if there is a chance to find cancer early. Finally, insurance generally will not cover supplemental screening, and doctors will not order it unless a woman is assessed to have a higher risk for breast cancer. In most instances, breast cancer risk is determined by whether a woman has a close relative, a mom or sister, that had breast cancer. Having dense breasts without a family history is not enough to place a woman in the high-risk category, even though 71% of breast cancers occur in women with dense breasts, and women with very dense breasts are 4 to 6 times more likely to get breast cancer. Federal law requires private insurers to cover many of the preventive services recommended by the USPSTF, but so long as the USPSTF remains undecided, private insurers are not required under federal law to cover supplemental screening for women with dense breasts. Medicaid coverage usually follows the USPSTF guidelines, but in the case of dense breasts, Medicaid covers supplemental screening. A pending congressional bill entitled Find It Early Act requires private insurance to cover supplemental screening for dense breasts. 25 states, not North Carolina, plus Washington, D.C., have passed laws requiring insurance coverage for expanded breast cancer screening. The costs of supplemental screenings are not prohibitive. The median price of a breast ultrasound is $127, and the out-of-pocket cost of an abbreviated breast MRI is $400, compared to the $100 median price of a mammogram. Studies have shown that the cost of early-stage breast cancer is one-third the cost of later-stage treatment. If found early, women have a better chance of avoiding chemotherapy and a double mastectomy and reconstruction. North Carolina legislators have legislated morality into significant aspects of women's health, including reproductive health. To avoid hypocrisy, we need legislation prioritizing women's access to life-saving breast cancer screening over insurers' profits. Sheila McHale is the former CEO of AskBio, a clinical gene therapy company. The quotables this week: the president's budget is the first step. The next step is an appropriation from Congress. That from Brian Litchfield, Town of Chapel Hill Transit Director on the Biden administration, recommending $138.3 million for the North-South Bus Rapid Transit Project, 5.7 miles of exclusive bus lanes and stations. The next quotable: today marks a significant milestone in Fortrea's ongoing journey as we sharpen our focus on organically growing as a pure-play CRO with added financial flexibility. That's from Tom Pike, CEO on Fortrea's decision to divest some of its assets in a deal worth up to $345 million. The Durham firm has an agreement to sell two of its business units to Arsenal Capital Partners. Another quotable: we want to provide a refreshing contemporary workplace, one that supports our focus on flexibility, collaboration, and the development of the next generation of legal professionals. That's Mac Paul, partner on Morningstar Law Group, leaving 421 Fayetteville Street for more space across the street in the Truist 2 Hanover Square Tower. It was purchased as an investment. It's a great center with quality long-term tenants. That's Chris Ehrenfield, owner of Chapel Hill's Bold Companies, on why an LLC tied to his company purchased a shopping center in Goldsboro for just shy of $10.5 million. Big number this week, $2.4 million. That's how many square feet a new industrial park in Hillsboro will be. Barrister Commercial Group broke ground on the Research Triangle Logistics Park, which is on 160 acres near the UNC Hospital's Hillsboro campus. We've run out of time for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Hugh Bennett, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Triangle Business Journal is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. So long until next time. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.